Hello, Richard.
Hello.
Richard Jordan, Jordan Richard.
Hi, Jordan.
Hi, pleased to meet you, Richard.
Yeah, you too.
Jordan, you need to say more.
As long as I live, I can't probably comment on anything like that, so...
I'll have to go back and listen to that bit anyway. You both ready?
Yep.
Yep.
I'm not. I've got cold. I've locked up my... Right. Welcome to episode 14 of Back to the Mac from the Q Broadcasting Network. On this week's show, we have special guest Jordan Merrick. After last week's solo show, we have special operations Richard Harkness. And we have me, with a cold, special needs Johnny Winter.
Johnny Winter then.
Yes, it's me, Johnny Winter, and welcome to episode 14 of Back to the Mac from the EQ Broadcasting Network. This week I've got Richard Harkness.
Hello.
And we've got Jordan Merrick. Hello, Jordan.
Hello. Hello, how are you doing, Johnny?
Yeah, good, thanks. Now, Jordan has a wealth of knowledge regarding all things Apple. He used to work as an Apple genius for a number of years. He's worked for a support company. I believe he still does work for a support company. And he's a prolific writer of stuff about Apple tutorials and tech. Would that be accurate, Jordan?
Yeah, that's spot on, actually. Yeah, it's exactly right.
Ah, good, we got something right. And I think, you know, bringing Jordan in, it means one of the three of us actually knows what we're talking about, which makes a nice change on Back to the Mac. So,
probably not a good idea to hype me up that much.
Well, I've done it now. You're going to have to live up to it. We start the show and we have this tongue twister where we try to say that we're Back to the Mac, a show about Mac stuff by Mac people for Mac people. The reason being Richard's wife wants to know what we're doing in our back bedrooms this late at night on the internet. It's all good, I promise. But that's, like I say, it's a bit of a tongue twister. So I thought we could change that maybe to Back to the Mac. We talk about Mac stuff. We don't do iOS.
Yeah, that'll do.
Yeah,
that sounds good.
Okay, we'll update it with that. So, Richard, thanks very much for doing episode 13 by yourself last week. I must say that first of all. Brave of you to step in and do a solo episode. If anybody's not listened to episode 13, go back and listen to that one first, please. Then come back. We'll wait for you.
Spoiler alert. you're welcome. I thought I'd put something out there to hold the fort for the week.
Excellent. Much appreciated. So let's kick off episode 14 then. I thought that we'd talk about Apple warranties. It's been in the news the last couple of days.
Who's going first?
It sounds like you volunteered there, Richard.
Well, it's not something I know a great deal about. All I know is Apple are getting bashed about the head a bit, really, aren't they, with this whole warranty issue. They've long been criticised about AppleCare and how it's effectively, in part, duplicating a consumer's rights in law anyway. And now in Australia, they've silently updated their consumer their policy regarding AppleCare to reflect this. I don't haven't had a chance to read any more detail about it. Now, has anyone had a chance to read that?
Jordan, what's your take on this?
Yeah, so with the issue with the Australia verdict is, because it's now it's always been 2 years over there. Apple's always maintained the position that their Apple Care Protection Plan will cover you for 3 years, obviously from the date of purchase. But the first year is warranty, and then the second year they're saying is with the retailer. So if you were to buy your Apple product from, say, the Australian equivalent of John Lewis, and you had a problem, then you need to go to John Lewis to get that sorted. So they would always position Apple Care as, no matter where you buy it from, you can get it serviced at an Apple store. And I think it's just a big disparity with the warranty systems around the world. In the US, warranties can be as short as 90 days, but here in Europe, I think we have the luxury of having warranties that are on average around 2 years, and Australia in the same boat as well. So I think Apple may be a little bit needing to probably playing catch up with the warranty, just because there is this big disparity between them. And I think it's really catching up with them now, especially with what happened in Italy last year.
Go ahead, Richard.
I was just going to ask there, Jordan, does that mean then when they're going to be advertising in Australia, effectively all they're going to be able to say is that you get an extra 1 year as opposed to 2 years?
I'm not 100% sure how they're advertising it at the moment, since I think the verdict was pretty recent, but from I remember reading on another site a couple of days ago that they'll still position that the AppleCare is covering an extra 2 years on top of the 1 year warranty. However, you will get another year in terms of service with your retailer. Now, the downside is, well, for Apple at least, that means for that second year, all the products that they sell in their Apple stores that are third party, they're covered, they have to cover as well. So whilst AppleCare might make sense if you don't want to have to deal with, you know, like I said, the Australian equivalent of, say, John Lewis or PC World, and having them to send your Apple computer off for repair, it also means if you buy a lessee hard drive from an Apple store, then and in 18 months it fails, you legally can go to that Apple store in 18 months' time and say, this isn't working, I'm covered for 2 years, this needs to be resolved by you. So it kind of is going both ways, effectively. Apple are maybe probably still touting the benefits of AppleCare, which there are still, but in terms of just the sheer service that if you want to get your machine repaired, then yeah, I think Apple are going to be having to be quite creative about how they word this and to keep on the right side of the law, effectively.
I think this is quite interesting, because when we look at AppleCare warranties for if you were to go in and buy a Mac, and as I understand it, if you buy a time capsule or any other product at the time, that's also covered within the AppleCare warranty. But if you go in and buy a Mac and you buy your AppleCare warranty, that takes your warranty from 1 year, as we understand it now, or before now, to 3 years. Of course, on the iOS devices, the AppleCare warranty only extends it by 1 year, so a total of 2 years. I know we don't do iOS, but I thought I'd make the distinction.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that also, like you said, that applies all to the entire iOS range on the Apple TV as well. So effectively, for a lot of people, it probably nullifies the option to have to purchase AppleCare in the first place for those types of devices.
What we're saying is there really is still a benefit to buying AppleCare if you're buying a Mac, because it's taking the warranty from, as we've understood it previously, 1 year. It's taking that to 3 years. And as I know from personal experience, going into the Apple store with something under AppleCare, you know, it doesn't really matter what condition the kit is in. They look at the problem and, you know, they'll sort the problem. It's service like I've never known before, apart from perhaps John Lewis, who incidentally do give you, you know, they make it very, very clear that they give you that second year of cover in the UK if you buy a Mac from them.
Yeah. One of the benefits of AppleCare that it isn't always talked about, especially when you're buying it from an Apple store or online, is it's a worldwide coverage as well. So you can buy this new MacBook Air from Australia 18 months later. If you're in America, then you're quite far away from the retailer you purchased it from in Australia. But with AppleCare, you can get it serviced at the Fifth Avenue store or serviced at an Apple service center.
That's
that AppleCare,
true.
Effectively, it's a get out of jail free card, effectively, for business people who need to get their machine serviced if they're frequent flyers.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because the cost of AppleCare, if I was to buy it in the States, is comparatively cheaper than if I was to buy it in the UK. So I could buy AppleCare from the States and cover my kit with AppleCare that I've bought over there, and it works out cheaper for me.
Yeah, I think theoretically that is fine, because AppleCare isn't limited to a region. And over here, and especially for students as well, the price is criminal. It's that cheap. I mean, even with if you buy a machine on the educational store, you don't necessarily get the full AppleCare, where you get the tech support, where you can call up at any time, but you get the hardware side of it, and you get that 3 years covered for free with the computer if you're a student. You just lose the option for the phoning in for technical support. But with the, you know, the amount of Apple stores there are around, then no one really needs to call up the Apple store or the Apple Care line, sorry. You can just waltz into an Apple store, book a Genius Bar appointment. If there's a fault, then they'll still repair it free of charge. So
I think for us in the UK, with the growing number of Apple stores, and I believe there's a new store opening in Leeds this weekend, with the growing number of Apple stores that we have, it is much easier for us to wander into an Apple store. But of course, there are certain parts of the world that don't have Apple stores at all, or if you're in the States, we're talking about great distances between cities. So, you know, maybe that telephone support lifeline does come in quite handy for a lot of people. I can't say that I've used it personally when I've had Apple Care, you know, because I'm very fortunate. I have an Apple store 2 miles away. So, you know, I just pop in there and have a chat with them. But I think the telephone support can be very useful for some people.
Definitely.
I don't know what the Brighton store's like for you, Johnny, but up here I've found increasingly that sort of Metro Centre and Newcastle are the ones that I'm closest to. I've got a, what would you call them, premium reseller in Durham. But I find that it's become, over the last maybe 2 years, it's become increasingly more and more difficult to get an appointment at the Genius Bar. It used to be relatively straightforward. I could nearly always guarantee I could book a date and a time that would be suitable. Now, often when I look, I can't get a date, so I have to keep looking back. I've tried occasionally just walking in. They don't seem to be allowing that as much now as used to be the case. I mean, previously they used to just say, take a seat, and if there's a gap, we'll squeeze you in.
Is this a consequence of their growing popularity?
Yeah, I think it is. I really think it is. You know, I don't think it's got anything to do with the products being more faulty or anything. I just think there's just so many more Apple customers now.
So certainly the store down here is absolutely rammed at times when I go in there. In fact, I've booked appointments there before. I mean, as you know from an earlier podcast, Richard, Jordan won't know because I don't think he bothers listening. You'll know that I took my iMac back in under warranty to have the hard drive replaced. I booked it in for 9 o'clock appointment to drop it off with them. I was having a coffee opposite, waiting for them to open, and there's people queuing outside before the doors have even opened, you know, like 8:45, 8:50. There's a queue forming already. I don't know, perhaps they just want to get in and play on the computers. And
yeah, your thing is, there a product Wi-Fi launch?
Yeah. You tend to know if it's somebody waiting for the Genius Bar, there'll always be at least one person in front of the shutters just before the store opens with an iMac in the box. And if you see that person, they're there for a Genius Bar appointment, and they've got the first one of the day.
Definitely, yeah.
that was me. So it seems that, the EU is saying that essentially we should have a 2-year warranty on electrical goods. And I think, you know, it's useful for these media outlets to put Apple on there. They're not singling out Apple. This is talking about warranties across a number of products. And I've been speaking to a chap on Twitter recently who has a Kindle, which is about 13 months old, and it's got some fault with the screen, and Amazon has basically washed their hands of it. And this seems to be a fault. I mean, there's some weasel words here. The issue is complicated in the sense of when the problems develop in the hardware. The EU directive, it says here, covers faults that existed at the time of purchase, not problems that develop later on. Which is included in some warranties, including Apple Care. It's trying to prove when the fault actually occurred. And I'm thinking back to my father-in-law's problems with his time capsule. It's long been known that, I mean, well, time capsules were replaced under warranty because of power supply issues. He had a time capsule that was about 22 months old, and it gave up the ghost, and he didn't get any support on that. And, you know, I've heard this time and time again. Perhaps we'll get some clarity, as they have in Australia, but I'm not convinced we're going to see that anytime soon.
No, I'm not convinced it should really change what people do. My stance would still be that I think Apple Care is worth the investment. You know, the amount of money that you pay for a Mac for the sake of the cost of Apple Care, and you know you're going to be well looked after whilst you're within Apple Care, I think it's still worth it, even if they couldn't, even if the EU law will protect you to some extent. And you know, I would think twice about buying an Apple product from anybody else. Actually,
I think, you know, I tend to agree with you, Richard. Whilst I think our consumer rights maybe are being trodden on a little bit, perhaps we aren't getting the service in the second year that perhaps we are entitled to expect, I think I would still agree with you in that the AppleCare warranty buys you such an excellent level of support, and also for the third year as well. Mm. And having been in a situation, the optical drive on my iMac here at home gave up the ghost long ago. I had a screen issue with the iMac at work. If these things had been covered under, you know, AppleCare, I wouldn't have had the problems that I'd had in getting things sorted. So, yeah, and the example Jordan gives, I think, you know, a business traveller, somebody who's travelling around the world, to have that peace of mind that if something happens, he can just pop into an Apple store and get it sorted. That worldwide warranty element is very useful as well.
And I think, especially with the ever increasing global number of Apple stores as well, it's increasingly more likely you'll be in a city where they do have an Apple store. So,
any final views on that, Jordan?
Like I said before, I think the main benefit of the AppleCare, regardless of what the warranty status is, and with that, even in the UK, because we're not a member state in the same way in the EU, in the same way as Spain and France are, there's certain things that we are involved in Europe, and there's certain parts of the European Union that we're not involved in. So things like the warranty was always a little bit of a grey area, because we didn't, you know, as Apple employees and as customers now, we don't really know exactly, do we have that 2 years over here, or are companies just offering that to us? Because we don't enjoy the same level of membership in the EU as everyone else does. We operate
I understand what you mean, Jordan. I think I think we do have the same level of membership. I know that we're just opted out of certain things, such as the euro as a currency, so we're not in the eurozone. We're opted out of the Schengen agreement, which allows free movement of people without, you know, within the EU without their passports, I believe. I think that's what it is. Yeah. You know, there are certain things like this. So, yes, I agree with you to an extent. But in terms of consumer law, I think that in the same way that European Convention on Human Rights, which we are signed up to, I think we're signed up to this European law thing. And certainly the articles that I've been reading is talking about 21 EU member states where Apple is not informing customers correctly about their warranty rights.
And that's the problem. It's not only Apple who aren't letting us know, is it? It's, like you said, it's a lot of other companies. And also, it's just, you know, consumer knowledge as well. I mean, we don't know. I mean, like you said, you know, we should be covered with these, yet we just don't know. It's all quite vague. It's all, you know, there's nothing specifically set in stone that we know that we can say exactly right, we need to be covered by this. And it's just like you said, where Apple probably need to be a bit more forthcoming about that. There's a line in this article that we've got on PC Pro which says, in at least 21 EU member states, Apple is not informing consumers correctly about the warranties that rights they have. So they're not saying Apple is necessarily lying or misleading, they're just not quite telling them, which means I think they really do need to be a bit more forthcoming about that. And just at the end of the day, I mean, I don't think a lot of people are not going to buy AppleCare because they realise, oh, I've got this extra warranty, but they're going to still want to buy AppleCare if they see it as a worthwhile investment, which, you know, I understand, you know, yourself and Richard know it's a worthwhile investment. So I think Apple probably need to be a bit more forthcoming about that and let the customers make their own decision.
I'll leave the listener with this top tip. AppleCare, if you're going to buy AppleCare, there are some reputable sellers on eBay, and there is the option of buying it from the States, where you can get it considerably cheaper than if you were to go into an Apple store and buy it. So that might be one way, but exercise caution. You know, don't just go buying an empty box with a red apple on it from somebody on eBay. So, okay, anybody fancy talking about Snow Leopard? That's a resounding no, then.
I found that a really interesting article, how many people are still using it.
Well, I was going to say 28% of our listener will be still interested in talking about Snow Leopard, because apparently 28% of people are still using Snow Leopard.
I can understand it, though. It was a rock-solid OS, wasn't it? And I was very hesitant about coming off it. It worked so well. I was like...
I think that view shared by a lot of people, Richard. This article that I'm looking at on Macworld is talking about more people currently using Snow Leopard than are using Lion.
That's very believable. I think there was quite a bit of negative press in the sort of tech community, wasn't there, around Lion? But I've got to say, I think Mountain Lion is a lot better than Lion was. So. Yeah. I think if you're on Snow Leopard, you know you're all right to make the jump now to Mountain Lion.
Yeah, I mean, with Snow Leopard, I think if more people are using Snow Leopard than Lion, it sounds feasible that of all the people running Lion, they wanted to get to Mountain Lion as quickly as possible. You know, like you said, Lion did have its fair share of issues, and the people who are on Snow Leopard are quite happy to stay on Snow Leopard, whether that's because they have software that they need to keep running on Snow Leopard, or they don't want to use Lion, or their Macs just don't support it. And I think everyone who has already made the jump to Lion, like I said, would probably have wanted to have moved on to Mountain Lion pretty sharpish.
Well, certainly there was some bad timing from Apple in terms of these upgrades. Of course, anybody who used MobileMe when they were using Snow Leopard, and that was me, if you wanted to retain that wireless syncing ability that we used to pay for under MobileMe, which was now free under iCloud, you had to move to a minimum of Lion. So you have to be on Lion or Mountain Lion in order to use iCloud. There is no iCloud compatibility with Snow Leopard. So that's really what forced me to move. And it was bad timing, I say, because the MobileMe service was switched off, was it July, the year before last?
Maybe, yeah.
Last year, I can't remember. And there was a period of time, I think maybe it was last year, there was a period of time of a couple of months when Mountain Lion wasn't available. You had to run with Lion in order to retain the wireless sync ability. And so I'd held off all that time from upgrading from Snow Leopard, and it was only when they cut off the MobileMe service, literally a week before they cut off MobileMe, that's when I upgraded to Lion. And then as soon as Mountain Lion came out a few weeks later, I upgraded again to that. And that whole process wasn't without its issues, really. You know, most of that can be sorted by a clean install of Mountain Lion. But, yeah, I mean, Snow Leopard, I loved it. My iMac would boot up in about 15 seconds. You know, it takes probably a good 3 or 4 minutes now under Mountain Lion.
So, yeah.
I think a lot of the issue with that, Johnny, from my experience, is I kind of got lazy a little bit because of the way Mountain Lion is. So I end up leaving lots of things open and windows open and just shutting down.
Yeah, I understand.
And I don't tick that little box to say, you know, close everything. So
I understand what you're saying, Richard, and that's certainly what people should be looking out for if they've got startup issues amongst the things they should be looking out for. But I actually went to the point of doing a reformat of the hard drive and a fresh install of the operating system, and it still takes longer. Now, I did a fresh install of the operating system. I put Snow Leopard back on. It's nice and clean, nice and fresh, and I actually timed it booting up and shutting down. Shutting down was near instantaneous. It was incredible.
Right.
And now with Mountain Lion, okay, I've got a number of applications on here now. But when it was a clean install, you know, I timed that for comparison and it was longer. And, you know, maybe that's to be expected. This is a Core 2 Duo. It's 3 years old now. You know, we're on newer processors now and, you know, perhaps the software is more demanding.
Have you got anything that's running an SSD now?
I haven't at the moment. I keep meaning to get an SSD. In fact, I installed an SSD on a PC for a chap at the office. He had a PC that was a couple of years old, and he's having performance issues. So I cloned his machine onto an SSD. We plugged that in. He's noticed a huge improvement in speed.
Yeah, because I understand, I'm not sure the technicalities, but my understanding was that Lion and Mountain Lion were optimised for SSD. So perhaps that's why you're getting a bit of slowdown, maybe, I don't know, on a normal drive, and then it performs well with an SSD. So
what we need, Richard, is an Apple expert who can answer that question.
One thing I have noticed with Lion, and more predominantly with Mountain Lion, is this: the new way Time Machine manages local snapshots. So I don't know the exact specifics of it, but I know there is a local snapshot system where it will still do backups even if you've not got your hard drive connected. It takes up a portion of the hard drive and just does some, you know, file versioning, just in case you change something on your laptop when you're not with your backup drive and you think, I really shouldn't have made that change. And I know for a fact when I'm shutting down my laptop at night and Time Machine's running, I will have to wait for Time Machine. I'll hit shut down, everything will close, and I'll just get the spinning gear for about 2 or 3 minutes until it decides to finish. And I'm wondering if that might be causing a lot of slowdown for some people as well.
That's very interesting, because, and not entirely related, although it is disc-related, there's a girl who's a graphic designer in the office. She works with a MacBook Pro and a separate Apple Cinema display. And she'd be working in Adobe, one of the Adobe products, and putting together a design. And then she'd come to do something like save it or load some new, I don't know what she does. But it would be after a period of time where she was working on it. And she was complaining about getting the spinning beach ball of doom. And what I narrowed it down to was the fact that the energy saving preferences were such that the hard drive was being put to sleep while she was still working on stuff, and obviously enough stuff was still in memory to enable her to work. And then when she'd take an action that required something else that wasn't in memory, or she needed to save it, it would need to wake the hard drive up. And there's a small period of time. It's only a few seconds, and on my old iMac it was quite noticeable because you could hear the disc spinning up again for a few seconds, and that's when you got the spinning beach ball of doom. But it's the most frustrating thing because, you know, you're working along and you don't know that the hard drive's going to sleep. You know, you carry on working. Obviously, it's not being used for 15 minutes, so it shuts down, and then you come to do something that requires it, and it takes a few seconds for it to warm up again, and that was quite frustrating. So we just turned off the energy saving preferences, and it's been fine for her since. So maybe it's something like that. I'm getting the spinning beach ball at the end because it's sorting out that file versioning that you're talking about, Jordan, and sorting out the backups. So yeah, maybe that could be to do with the shutdown issues.
I think a lot of the time as well, with in addition to that, I think if any Mac was originally shipped with Snow Leopard or was designed to use Snow Leopard from launch, I think they have more of a difficult time with Lion and Mountain Lion in general than, say, a later Mac that shipped with Lion as standard. Lion and Mountain Lion, even their minimum specs say they need 2 or 4 gigabytes of RAM. It's really low for what it can do. It's always happened with Intel machines where they've said, this is your minimum specs. And we used to say, and I always say to people now, it's the minimum specs. It'll get you going with it, but you really shouldn't operate on that. And I think with these processors, that might be doing it.
Mountain Lion is supposed to run, I think, with a minimum
2.
I think it is.
But it needs 4, I think, minimum. Absolutely minimum. In real life. Yeah.
If you try running Mountain Lion on a Mac with 2 gigabytes, it's just so sluggish. It really is very slow. And, yeah, but perhaps there's something in that. I mean, all the processors, i5s and i7s now, the iMac I have is a Core 2 Duo. It came with Snow Leopard. It was brand new, came with Snow Leopard when I bought it. And, you know, we've moved on 2 iterations of the operating system now, which is essentially what this article is talking about on Macworld, saying that Apple is perhaps not ready to kill off Snow Leopard just yet, which is a little out of character with how it moves on and drops previous operating systems. But they do seem to be ramping up the speed at which they're replacing the operating systems, you know. So we're expecting 10.9 later this year, aren't we?
Yeah, I think it allows them to be a bit more controlled rather than, say, a jump from back when Tiger was out to Leopard and then Leopard to Snow Leopard. Those are pretty big jumps. So I think ever since they released Snow Leopard and then Lion and Mountain Lion, the less they do and the more frequent the updates, the less that could go wrong, or the less that can present problems in the future. So it probably helps Apple in a way that, you know, nice and steady, they can release update after update, but they're all incremental. You know, there's nothing revolutionary about each one. Just in case this one revolutionary feature they've been touting for a while all of a sudden disappears. This happened on the AirPod Extreme when it first came out, the one with the USB port where you could plug a hard drive in. When it was announced, it was said that you could use it with a Time Machine, and then all of a sudden it disappeared for a year. And it was just a feature that wasn't ready. So they advertised that it was going to do it, and then all of a sudden, before it was released, all mention of Time Machine USB drives was dropped, and it never appeared until it was unofficially supported in an update that was released about a year or two later. So I think they're trying to slow their progress for the sake of their customers and the sake that they don't want to keep introducing these problems, because, you know, it's something the media will jump on straight away if something like that happened again with whatever
that is. Of course, the changes from Tiger to Leopard and Leopard to Snow Leopard were revolutionary changes, really. You had Tiger, which was running on the old PowerPC machines. Leopard, I believe, ran on both PowerPC and Intel.
So did some of the later Tiger releases as well.
Did they?
Yeah, 10.4.6 onwards was also Intel, but they were so different that, unlike Leopard, where you eventually had like a completely universal disk you could boot both from, Tiger was very much, it was as though it was sort of added on at the end. It was an additional hack, if you will. So it wasn't ideal, but it worked, and the Intel machines benefited so much from it. And Leopard was the first one, I think, designed specifically from launch to be PowerPC and Intel.
Sure. And then, of course, the move from Leopard to Snow Leopard, the slimming down of the code base, the optimization, and having Rosetta in there to support the PowerPC programs if you were still running those.
That's a good point. Maybe the reason they're still having to support Rosetta is, believe it or not, I bet there are still a lot of PowerPC users out there who have got what they did pay thousands of pounds for, Adobe or Avid software, that although is quite long in the tooth now, Snow Leopard is the last version of OS X that will run PowerPC applications. So maybe they're supporting that in a way just to help these last people finally move on, if you will, you know, and get away from these old PowerPC applications that Snow Leopard is the last one to support.
Interestingly, the installer for Microsoft Office for Mac 2008, the installer requires Rosetta. So if you want to install, if you insist on installing Microsoft software on your Mac and you've got Microsoft Office 2008, you need to have Snow Leopard on there so that the installer will run and then install this insidious code all over your hard drive. If you do a fresh install and put Mountain Lion straight on there, you won't be able to install the Microsoft software. You'll have to go back, put Snow Leopard on, install it, and then upgrade your operating system.
Wow. Interestingly, that something we touched on there is relevant to one of the other things that we were going to mention tonight about the release of 10.8.3. I'm pretty sure on the keynote for Mountain Lion, that I'm sure they previewed the ability to use your iTunes gift card with your camera, or at least it was talked about at the time.
Yeah.
And I, for ages, when it came out, I was like, right, let's give this a go then. And it just wasn't there. They hadn't implemented it. And when it suddenly came up in the notes, I was like, oh, right, now you've brought it in on the 0.3 release, you know? And also, you've got bootcamp support for Windows 8, which will keep some people happy, and better use of supporting 3 terabyte drives now. And I wondered whether this was perhaps they brought this in, I don't know, just speculating, in readiness for the Mac Pro when that comes out.
for the 3 terabyte storage for boot camp.
Do you think so? Yeah. I mean, CEO chap, Paul O'Grady, he was talking last year about Mac Pro, saying to people who are hanging on for the Mac Pro, just hang in there, we're going to have something really special for you next year. Surely the launch of the Mac, if they do update the Mac Pro, as a lot of people expect this year, it's going to come with the next version of OS X. It's going to be 10.9. They're not going to put it on 10.8.3 or 0.4, are they?
Probably, yeah.
I don't know.
I think maybe if they can implement it now, they may as well. Then it saves them having to worry about it, I suppose, in the future. And if they do implement a 3 terabyte drive now and someone with an existing Mac Pro starts to use a 3 terabyte drive and it starts working for, say, boot camp. But is the 3 terabyte drive to support within boot camp, or is that just Mac support in general? Because I would have assumed it would work okay with a Mac, unless boot camp had a problem with the size of the partition.
It wouldn't allow more than 2 terabyte partitions, I think, or something, from memory.
Right.
Which was causing people some headaches.
That's a large partition for boot camp, isn't it? 3 terabytes is a
large. Yeah, why on earth would you want to give that much over to you?
I know, yeah. It baffles me. Yeah, I mean, if you've got a Mac Pro at the moment with 4 drive bays, and even if you filled all 4 of them with 3 terabytes, that's a lot of storage just to have for Windows. But unless you're using it every day for a lot, and then at that point, it's probably just worth having a separate PC just to do that.
Yeah, just have a PC separately.
Yeah. It seems like an awful shame to spend all that money on some shiny glass and aluminium, or just some shiny aluminium, and run Windows on it. That's a shame.
Especially Windows 8 as well, which, you know, it's not exactly Microsoft's finest hour at the moment in terms of an operating system. So, yeah, that's a lot of storage for an operating system not a lot of people want to run anyway.
Do either of you feel just a slight, I don't know, trepidation about 10.9? Because I think my feeling is there could be some fairly major overhauls in terms of the UI GUI, I should say. Because of the move away from the skeuomorphism and what have you.
Well, I was reading something about that recently, and, you know, these things, I think, are developed so far in advance. You know, there's been a lot of talk, a lot of excitement about Jonathan Ive taking over now that Scott Forstall has left. You know, Johnny Ive taking over as head of human interface development, I think they're calling it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this move away from these skeuomorphic design elements to a much slicker, cleaner interface that more closely resembles the machines, how they're designed themselves. Mm. But what I was reading was saying, well, you know, the groundwork for whatever the next iteration of OS X is will have been worked on for so long that they can't just go stripping all this stuff out now. We'll probably see it in the iteration after that. So I don't know whether we're going to see that in 10.9. We really need
Okay.
a code name. But like anything, Richard, all this is speculation, isn't it?
I don't think it would be on, but I personally don't think it would be beyond Apple to turn that around.
Well, some chap
when they want to get something done, they'll get it done, you know.
Well, some chap in Scandinavia produced a little tool so that you could rip all the skeuomorphism out of calendar and stuff, didn't he? I forget what it's called now, that little thing. It's not perfect, but it's a good stab. But yeah, I mean, okay, so the next iteration of OS X, what are we going to see? We're going to see integrated Siri, Apple Maps, maybe like a skeuomorphism.
Yeah, I definitely like to see Siri there. I mean, Siri's great on the iPhone and iPad, but to have Siri on the Mac where I'm at 8 hours a day would actually be quite useful, especially if it could be something that was separate and isn't something that's overlaid on the Mac interface. So with Siri on the iPhone, you obviously hold down the home button and Siri's there in front of you ready to go. But if I could be working and have Siri doing something else for me in the background, such as, I don't know, looking up a movie time or something, you know, starting small, that could be quite useful. But I would be hesitant to see more, I don't know what it's called, but iOSification of OS X, with things like Launchpad and Notification Center. I opened Notification Center for the first time in what must have been a long time today, because I had notifications going back a month that weren't cleared. So some of these features that I'm just not seeing from iOS that I'm not really using day to day. So I'd hope that if anything else was going to come over, that it'd be features that are there that would actually be a help, rather than to say, well, iOS had it, so let's put it in OS X, like Launchpad.
Yeah, I share that view on Notification Center. The problem with Notification Center for me, a notification popped up for me today from Jacob, and I glanced at it. I saw it was from Jacob, and I didn't catch what the message said. And I couldn't find it in iMessage. I couldn't find it in Twitter. I couldn't find it somewhere else. I had no idea how he'd communicated with me. It was just this thing that flashed up in Notification Center and then buggered off again. And I had to open it up and have a look down all my unread things to see where this message came in. And I mean, it might have been an email. To tell you the truth, I still can't remember where it came in. But it's...
There's something. Wouldn't that be brilliant if you could just talk to Siri and say, "Show me the last notification from Jacob."
That would be very good.
Wouldn't that be amazing? You know, if you have that level of functionality, that'd be superb.
Well, iOS, you know, not to try and get to iOS at any point. I know the most that can do is you can ask Siri to read back your last text message.
Yeah.
And that tends to be about it. But yeah, to be able to find out what the last notification was, and so you don't have to stop what you're doing and navigate to Notification Center, that'd be great.
You know, or show me the last email Johnny sent me, you know, that sort of thing. That would be fantastic. The trouble with Siri is it's not rock solid yet. When it works, it's fantastic, but the number of times it doesn't work the way you want it to, and yeah, it feels like you end up wasting time when it goes wrong. It doesn't.
Sometimes you think, "Oh, I'll just tap out this bloody message myself."
Yeah,
yeah.
And also, it doesn't work where you, of course, on the iOS devices where Siri is at the moment. It doesn't work if you don't have a 3G or Wi-Fi signal.
Yeah, it's still very much reliant on a data connection. Yeah. Also, it is sometimes counterintuitive, so if they were going to implement things like Siri into OS X, then I think they really need to focus on getting the services better before they start doing anything like that. I mean, Siri, is it still in beta at the moment?
They've never said it's not.
So, I mean, they can always hide that. I mean, Gmail used that for years, where they just had that beta message saying, "No, it's not quite ready yet." But for us to really take that seriously in OS X, they'd really have to work on the services before they rolled anything like that out. But
the thing is, Google and Apple are very different companies in that respect. Google is a company full of nerds, or previously full of nerds, rolling out these interesting products that were sort of half-baked and had no design element at all to them and are incredibly difficult to use. It's only recently they've actually been applying some sort of style to what they do, and they are getting much, much better. Mm. And Apple has always steered clear of announcing products as beta products and just coming out with a product. And of course they do the continual improvement thing, but they'll come out with a product, and it's very unusual for them to come out with a product and call it a beta.
I think they needed to do that to get the data coming in to improve Siri. I think that's why they had to do it.
That's a valid point.
But it makes you wonder when they're going to do something or release something that will improve Siri further, because I never hear people saying, "Hey, I've really noticed that Siri's a lot more accurate now."
It's a gradual thing, isn't it, Richard? It's like turning up the heat on a pan of frogs or something, isn't it? Yeah. They don't notice it. You know, drop them in the hot water and they'll notice it straight away. Yeah. So I think it's a gradual thing. It's gradual improvements. And I think the same's been happening with Apple Maps.
I like the idea, Johnny, of Tim Cook sitting with a lever saying, you know, "Turn up the reliability."
Who's Tim Cook? Who's Richard? Who's Tim Cook?
You know, Paul O'Grady.
Oh, that's the one. That's the one. It is.
This is good. If there's anybody listening from anywhere outside the UK, that's going to be totally lost on them.
That's what Google's for, isn't it?
Yeah, you'll have to Google Paul O'Grady.
Let's talk about MacBook Pro Retinas, shall we?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're busted.
Moving on.
Is that all you want to say about them?
There's a few problems, isn't there? But I mean, like, it's to be expected with any bit of new hardware. But displays, apparently there's two different displays in the MacBook Pro Retinas, one made by Samsung, one made by LG. If you happen to be the lucky soul that has the LG version, then it's more prone to ghosting and image retention. So that's when you have, say, like a menu or a login screen, and if you leave it on your display for a long time, when you click off that and go on to do something else,
so this is reminiscent. This is reminiscent of those cash points that you go to with the old CRT screens, and they've got permanently etched into them, you know, the press this button for cash, press this one for receipt. Do you want a receipt? It's got that information burnt into the screen, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that was a blue screen of death.
I've seen that actually on cash points.
That always cracks me up. Yeah. So that's one of the issues, and I think that's the one that somebody in the States, as always, is trying to create a class action lawsuit about it. Good luck. And then there's also been some problem with fan noise and the fans revving up too much as well in some of them. But I believe that's now fixed with an update. So there you go.
So, okay, I mean, it's a lot of money to sink into one of those machines, isn't it? It's I mean, I don't think I'd be too happy if I was having ghosting issues on the screen. Mm. If I'd put, I mean, what are they? I can't remember how much they are. They're a lot of money. I wouldn't be too pleased with that. I think I'd be talking to Apple saying, can I have one with a Samsung screen, please?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, though, isn't it? I don't think it's fair if they're going to put screens in that are not, you know, exactly the same in terms of quality. That doesn't seem right to me at all, that.
Yeah.
I don't mind if it comes from LG, if it performs exactly the same as the Samsung one.
Well, it shouldn't matter, should it? I mean, you'd expect these big companies to have different suppliers of parts.
Yeah, but it's just probably more for the fact that they can get the amount of parts that they need. So these Retina displays are still pretty new, and it looks like Samsung, they're able to provide the panels that work fine. LG probably said they will be able to provide the panels that will work fine, and unfortunately LG look like they may have dropped the ball somewhat. And unfortunately, because it's in a product with an Apple badge and it's the end product for the end user, the buck stops with Apple, unfortunately, and it's their supplier. So it's all well and good for Apple to say, well, it's an LG panel, we're sorry about that. Like you said, Johnny, it's a lot of money, and at the end of the day, if you're having to buy a computer and one panel may not work quite like the other, they should do. So it's probably just because they've had to get so many parts, and LG probably just haven't been able to quite nail down the manufacturing, and it's just left, from the look of it, a lot of customers unhappy about that.
And certainly we know Apple has been having manufacturing issues in terms of time getting products to the stores recently, with the introduction of the new iMac. I know that those are only now starting to come through with shorter lead times. So it's certainly, I mean, another consequence of the popularity of the Mac products, I suppose. You know, there's so much demand for these things. Apple has a job trying to get these very high quality screens made.
Yeah, definitely.
So, okay, I think what I'd say to the listener on that one is, if you're buying a Retina MacBook Pro, make sure you get some Apple Care warranty on it. Regardless of the situation on EU consumer warranties. Steve Jobs movies. Ashton Kutcher, his movie's been delayed, I understand. So there's another one going to make the... it's going to be the first Steve Jobs biopic. Who knows about this?
Only what has been published in the last day or two. This kind of, I think, took everyone by surprise. And it's the I'm a Mac guy as well. I was not expecting that in any way. He really is wanting to be a Mac. I mean, I'm not too sure what to say about it, really. I've not really seen a trailer, or apart from this one picture of him potentially, obviously, taking the iconic Steve holding his beard to his face picture.
So when you say I'm a Mac, what is this? Is this the adverts with the fat bloke in a bad suit and the trendy hipster?
Yeah, I mean, in the UK, we had Mitchell and Webb do them over here for a short time. In the UK, yeah. It's John Hodgman and Justin Long. And he did it for, it was a number of years, and it was one of Apple's most successful campaigns, whether or not people, you know, people have got dividing opinions on it. People, some people really liked them, some people really didn't like them. So it's just kind of, it's not just a coincidence, but it just does seem kind of a surprise that the Mac guy is now also going to be Steve Jobs as well. So it depends how much of this...
This is the hipster guy with the blue T-shirt and jeans.
Yep. Yes, yeah. This is the guy who very much tried not to be condescending to the PC guy, but often came off as condescending to the PC guy. I don't know, it depends on if this is going to be a parody that's going to be in lighthearted, or is this just going to be a typical Funny or Die, really taking the mickey, you know, just doing it for a laugh, in which case, I don't know what to think of it, really.
I'm not familiar with the work of Funny or Die, I'm afraid.
No,
so
me neither.
They're basically a website. It's like YouTube, but set up by comedians like Will Ferrell, and it's just a lot of comedians who, every now and again, in between films that they do, they'll try and make a funny skit, and some of them are good, some of them are bad. So, but it, you know, overall, there are some good funny things on there, but I've never heard of them do films before, so I think this is maybe a first for them.
It sounds like something, it doesn't really say it. Yeah, oh, there it does. It released online, so it's not coming to cinemas or anything. Mm. So, yeah, it'll probably be released through their website, won't it? It'll be worth a watch, won't it?
Well, you know, coming to Richard's home cinema soon.
Absolutely.
I can still imagine it being better than the Ashton Kutcher one from what I was saying about that. So, and I also like the line it said, it started as an idea to make a fake Steve Jobs trailer, then it snowballed into a 75-minute film. So,
how does that happen?
That's a long trailer.
This started off as a 15-minute podcast, and it snowballed into a 60-minute ramble. So,
I was just going to say at least there's something that's actually coming out, because we still haven't heard anything about the Walter Isaacson movie yet. That's still being written, isn't it?
Is that the one that's been written by, is it Aaron Sorkin?
That's it, yes. I haven't heard, there's not a peep coming out about that, and obviously being very, very
tight. Probably because that's the one that's going to be good.
One. Yeah.
So, okay. Another story this week. You can get a skinny iMac now that comes in with a built-in Visa mount. Is it Visa or Vesa?
I don't know. Visa, I would say.
I'd say Visa as well, yeah.
You say Visa, I say Vesa. Let's call the whole thing off. So basically, it's the new skinny iMac from Apple, and instead of coming with the aluminium leg, it comes with the Visa mount attached already. And the difference between this and the previous iMac, where you could have either the Visa mount or the aluminium leg, with this you pay $40 more for the mount, and you can't have the leg.
So it's an either or choice.
It's an either or choice.
You see, that's a shame, because I would go for that if you could still use a leg mount with it. At least you'd have the flexibility there, but that's a bit of a tough choice.
Yeah, I don't know. I suppose if you need your Mac mounted with one of these Visa mounts, you've got some sort of arm or some sort of stand, maybe you've got two screens together, then, you know, that's your setup, isn't it? How often are you going to be changing it?
I would, if I was looking for an iMac, I would actually go for the Visa mount option, so I could use a height adjustable stand. One of the things I've always disliked about the iMac stand is it's a great swivel stand and it looks gorgeous, but it's not height adjustable. Mm. So you could use this with, as Johnny said, like a desk stand or even a clamp that is on a retractable arm. So depending on your circumstance, just having this with an adjustable height desk stand would actually probably be a lot better for a lot of users, where some people may be suffering from things like RSI and making sure that the display is lined up correctly, and, you know, and also wall mounts as well, obviously. But I'd definitely pay the extra $40 and then just buy my own Visa mount. At least then I know that I can angle this, and a lot of Visa mounts you can swivel to portrait mode as well. So, although I don't think the weight would probably help with the 27-inch iMac in portrait mode, it'd probably have a very high centre of gravity.
Well, I think these new skinny iMacs, Jordan,
very heavy
are much, much lighter than the previous ones.
I think even if I had a really heavy stand, I'd be worried it might fall over if I put it in portrait mode. But yeah, I mean, I'd definitely go for one with a Visa mount and get my own stand. I think it's a good option.
Do you think it's worth paying $40 extra for? I mean, why not pay the same? In fact, you're losing a lot of aluminium.
Yeah.
I mean, the aluminium you're losing is probably worth about $80.
Yeah, I think it should probably be the same price, but I think it's one of these where they're so infrequently manufactured, I suspect that if you're paying the $40, they'll probably have the factories open them up and change them. So it's probably an additional cost to Apple to change the mounts over. And up until some of the previous generation iMacs, I think up until the original aluminium iMac, you could change the stand by adjusting a couple of screws and you could take it off if you had the correct tools. After that, if you wanted a Visa mount, everything had to come out of the computer. So the display, the logic board, and then you'd get to the chassis and then change the mount over. So I'm wondering if this extra cost is just to cover the fact they pay somebody to change them out afterwards.
Yeah, it will be. Because it's sort of an atypical setup, isn't it? And they're probably going to view it as a niche product. It'll be interesting to see what the demand.
But the fact that on these new skinny iMacs, the screen is bonded, isn't it? It's all this friction stir welding stuff that's going on. So are they really taking these things apart in order to change the mount? Surely they'll just do short runs of Visa mount skinny iMacs. And maybe that's what you're paying for. You're paying the extra for because it's just a short run.
Very possibly,
maybe. Yeah. You might be right there. It's just an extra manufacturing cost. This does tie up quite nicely with the fact that an educational model iMac came out recently. So these may be created to actually roll out with things like schools, especially K-12 in the States. So this might be tying up quite nicely with a big Apple push towards education again.
Okay.
Oh, is it the forerunner for the Apple TV?
Well, 27-inch display, actually, that's a good point. 27-inch screen in your living room. I'm not surprised if a few people buy these to wall mount in their living rooms.
Yeah. Wouldn't be that bad, would it?
If money was no object, certainly a tempting proposition. I'm going to move on to hot hardware software of the week. Richard, I think you've selected something this week. Tell us about that.
Was that me? Yeah. it was just a little thing. I thought it might be useful.
Richard, you shouldn't prejudge these hot hardware things. That's my job.
Well, I know you're going to panic, Johnny. So basically, what this is, it's a small bit of software called Flash Drive Backup that you can get from the Apple Mac Store. And I just thought that I liked the idea of it and the simplicity of it. And thinking back to when I used to use USB drives regularly as part of my workflow, it would make life a lot more simple. Because the idea with this is you tell it to look for a certain USB drive. Whenever you plug that into your Mac, it will automatically begin backing up the contents of it. And it's as simple as that. I like the idea.
Let me understand this right. You've got a USB drive, you plug it into your Mac, and this software will back up the data from the USB drive to your Mac.
Yes.
But most people use USB drives to back up data from their Mac onto the drive.
Well, you see, with my workflow, you see, I used to keep a lot of documents and invoices and things like that on a USB stick because I needed to be able to create them and print them off wherever I was going. So for me, that would work because, you know, I would stick it in. All the invoices that were only at that time on the USB stick would then be automatically backed up on my Mac. So there is a use case for it.
I would actually use this, definitely. I mean, I've lost so many USB sticks in my time and I don't use USB sticks now because I lose them too quickly. And I always have that one file that I wish I'd copied to my Mac. And I just thought, well, it's on a USB stick. It's in my pocket.
Yep.
It's not that important. And it's gone. And I don't use USB sticks for that reason. So something like this, if I was to use USB sticks again, I'd be using this in a heartbeat because I've been stung so many times doing that.
I used to use USB drives right up until the point Dropbox became available, and then I started using Dropbox. Now, my work setup is I have a 27-inch iMac at home. That's the one I'm using to record this podcast. I have a 27-inch iMac, easy for me to say, at work as well. And I chose that particular setup because I like the large screens. I find it comfortable to work that way. And I didn't want to be carrying a MacBook Pro between two locations all the time. It means I can just walk to work. The heaviest thing I've got is an iPhone or an iPad sometimes. And with Dropbox and with iCloud and with the way we work with our heads in the clouds these days, is that I can have all of my data regardless of which machine I'm at. So I don't tend to use the USB drives for storing data in that sense anymore, because everything's in the cloud for me and then backed up on different machines. When I do use USB drives, it's normally to create some sort of boot drive for Lion or Mountain Lion or some Linux distros, or, dare I say it, Windows. I've got a Windows USB boot stick as well. But
Is that in a small tin box with a Hazard logo on it?
That's the one. Yeah.
In case of Armageddon, break glass.
In fact, I'm not allowed to be in a public place with that USB drive. It's so dangerous. When you say there's a use case scenario for this, Richard, yeah, I agree with you. There is a use case scenario for it. I'm just not sure who would be using it. But then, of course, Jordan pipes up and says he'd use it.
Well, having said that, it's not that long ago since I moved over to doing things in the cloud. And I tend to use iCloud more because I don't know why, just that's where I've gone. But I do use Dropbox as well. So if I'm using it, I suspect there's a lot of people who are still using USB sticks day in, day out. So I think there is a use case there, Johnny. But to be fair, we're probably better off telling people, for God's sake, stop using a USB stick and start using a cloud service, because that's the future.
I think for a lot of people who are using it, I think for people like us who use Dropbox, I think USB sticks have had their day. But for students who are using public machines, and for people who go to, if they still exist, internet cafes where they're not using a computer that isn't theirs. So students, like I said, especially, may find this quite useful where they're taking work into school or to college or wherever, and they're doing something on one of public library machines, and then they leave, provided they don't leave it in the back of the machine. But having this backup system is probably quite useful for those types of people. But I can see it only ever declining because of the ubiquitousness of Dropbox and even iCloud in a way, the fact people are using these systems now. But yeah, I think it has got its use, but I think it is a small use nonetheless.
Yeah, you know what? I think there definitely is a use case scenario for this. There are people out there, and certain people, they feel comfortable knowing that their data is backed up on this little stick. Even if it does sit next to their computer all the time, they know that the data exists in a second place. It's on their machine. It's on this stick. They may only have the one machine, but that's what gives them the comfort, the peace of mind, the security. So I can see a use case scenario for this. I can also see a use case scenario if I think back about 10 years ago. I was on the train. I was using a PC laptop at the time, and I had a USB stick. Back when they were quite new and quite expensive, I had a USB stick plugged into the back of the back of the laptop. We pulled into Brighton Station, of course, because I'd been engrossed in my work. I hadn't noticed we'd arrived already. So in a scramble to get the machine shut down and get my coat and so on, shut the machine down, shut the lid, put it into my bag, wondered why it wouldn't go smoothly into my bag, and really rammed it down. I gave a big push on this laptop to get it to fit into the bag and then close the bag. It wasn't until I got home, pulled out the laptop, there's this USB stick, which, as I say, very expensive at the time, very low capacity as well, just sort of absolutely knackered on the back of the laptop. So from that point of view, damage and loss, there's probably two reasons there to be using it. Although I would question you know, if you're needing that sort of backup, then do look at some sort of cloud storage service, because if you're using just one PC, then your data exists. When I say PC, personal computer, I mean Apple Mac, of course. Don't use PCs in the traditional sense, not the Wintel ones. Neil Cochran, if you're listening, get rid of your PC and get a Mac. It's about time. You know, it makes sense. So, you know, to those people using USB drives, really move over to a cloud service like Dropbox. If you just use the one machine, then your data exists on your machine and in the cloud. So you've always got a backup. So if the worst happens to your machine, it gets broken, stolen, burnt in a fire, your data is still safe. If, like me, you've got machines in two places, then it's synchronizing the data between the two and backing it up. USB drives, I think they have had their day, really. I mean, it's a minority now, surely.
Yeah, it's been a while since anyone from the government has owned up to losing a USB stick with hundreds of thousands of names on it. So I think maybe they are waning in their use.
Yeah. So, OK, let's have a vote on this. Jordan, hot or not?
Hot, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Richard, hot or not?
Hot if you need to use it.
And what's my role in the hot or not each week?
It's to say not, isn't it, Johnny?
Well, you know, I can see a use case scenario for this. And if you do use USB drives, then perhaps it's something you should look at. But I really do think you should get with the program, move into the 21st century, look at some cloud service, you know, in terms of backup. This particular, I can see the uses of this software. I'm on the fence with this one, actually. It's neither hot nor not.
I think it's hot because if you need to use that thing, but like you say, it's our public.
Well, what do you mean by that thing? Can't you bring yourself to say its name anymore, Richard?
Flash drive. Yeah, if you're still using, you know, yesterday's technology, then I think it's very useful.
There you go, Neil Cochran. If you're listening, if you're still using yesterday's technology, move into today and get yourself a Mac. So, okay, I tell you what, this has been a really interesting chat with you two guys. I've really enjoyed having Jordan on this week. Thanks very much, Jordan. Whereabouts can people find you on the internet?
So I'm on Twitter at Jordan Merrick, Jordan. I'm also on app.net, same username, and I write at MacTuts and sparsebundle.net.
Now, if anybody hasn't looked at sparsebundle.net, I recommend they do. It's a really interesting website. There's lots of insightful pieces of writing on there. I really enjoy reading it, actually, Jordan. It's I don't think it's your typical stuff. You know, it's stuff written with some thought behind it. And the one thing that you wrote last week where you didn't think it through properly, I think I managed to change your mind on that, didn't I?
You did a little bit, yes. So for anyone who doesn't know, this goes back, what was it? In-app purchases, wasn't it? By
it
a
was.
Child, was it £1,000?
I think it was more than
take.
That.
Was it more than that?
Ouch.
I may have inadvertently, or not inadvertently, but may have been a little bit hot-headed when I took to Twitter to vent my frustration at the fact that, you know, iOS does have parental controls. Why weren't they in use? But I think in hindsight, yeah, maybe it was a bit of education on Apple's part, which they're actually addressing now since they added a huge section to the App Store on the iPad where it says Guide for Parents and it talks about parental controls and it talks about passcode lock. So I think Apple are definitely doing their part in that.
I actually think this is a situation where neither Apple is to blame nor are parents to blame. It's just a situation that's come about because there's this 15-minute window after a password has been entered. And, of course, if a parent has downloaded a game for a child, and I don't know, are there any freemium apps, what do you call it, in-app purchase? Are there any like that in the Mac App Store?
Yep.
I think there are, aren't there?
Yep,
Well, let's steer it round. Let's suppose the parent is on their Mac and they've downloaded a because we are a Mac show, aren't we? We don't talk iOS. The parent has downloaded games on the Mac. There's a 15-minute window in which the child would be able to, you know, purchase in-app purchases. And I was just thinking in my mind, if I go to a website and, you know, buy my son a new pair of football trainers, I don't expect to walk away from my Mac and for him to be able to have a 15-minute shopping window where he can go around and buy all sorts of things. Although, oh, I'm sure he'd love it. But, you know, I think it's unintended consequences, isn't it? It's the fact that, you know, this is the way it works. You know, parents, you know, let their kids play on this kit for whatever reason, and this happens. I don't think either party is really at fault on this one. So that's my view. Anyway, so sparsebundle.net for Jordan and at Jordan Merrick on Twitter and app.net. Richard, where can we find you?
Probably the best place to get me is on Twitter, Rich Harkness. I'm also the same Rich Harkness on app.net, but I never seem to get the time to get on there these days. And my blog as well, areyougettingit.co.uk, which has been fixed. If anyone has tried to access it recently, it was busted, so it's working again now.
I tell you what, Richard, you should have a quiet chat with Jordan after and ask about blogs and stuff, because he does some cracking stuff with websites and how they're set up as well, the technicalities. So have a chat with him sometime. And I'm Johnny Winter. You can find me at about.me/JohnWinter and on Twitter at Johnny_Winter and app.net at Winter. For the show, we've got a Twitter account at BTTMPodcast. You can also follow Q Broadcasting. You can. What is it? At Q Broadcasting, I suspect. If not, have a look at Q.am. That's Q-U-E.am. And we're on there. Get in touch with us. Let us know what you'd like us to talk about. What I should compel you to do is go and review us on iTunes. If you enjoyed the show, give us 5 stars and write a little bit saying what you enjoyed about the show. I'll certainly be going on there after we finish recording this one and saying I... but you don't know what I'm going to write yet, Richard. I'll be going on
Johnny
there.
Johnny Winter's a marvellous host.
No, I was going to go on there and say this Jordan chap. He's the first chap on Back to the Mac that actually knows what he's talking about. So
I'll be writing a review just saying this is the first time I've bothered to listen to this show, and I must say it's quite good.
So please go onto iTunes. If you enjoyed the show, give us 5 stars and tell us why you enjoyed it. If you didn't enjoy it, bugger off. Get a PC, go and join Neil Cochran and talk about Windows 8. There you go, Neil. I've given you at least 3 mentions on this week's show.
Not the way you'd like, but...
Hope you're happy. Oh, one more name check. I need to say hello to James Hart, who is at Syzygy. I'm not going to spell it for you because it's just a random collection of letters. He does a show called Late Night Loaf. Follow him at Late Night Loaf. We've missed the first half an hour of his show this evening because he broadcast live and we're recording on Tuesday night. But do check that out. Thank you very much, James. He gave us a little plug last week, Richard.
Yeah, you can now get it as a podcast feed as well, because I tend to listen to it that way because I just kind of keep awake for until midnight every night.
That's it. So anyway, this has been the longest show we've recorded. I think it's been a really good one. I've enjoyed talking to both of you. So, you know, thanks very much for your time. I hope that the listener enjoys it too. My throat's about to conk out now because I'm suffering from this cold and I haven't got any water and I don't think I can go much longer. Thanks very much to Tariq Greenfield for the show's music. That's the best bit of the show, apart from Jordan. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Cheers, Johnny.
That was Back to the Mac, episode 14 from the Q Broadcasting Network. You can follow us at BTTM Podcast, or you can look us up on the Q Broadcasting website. That's Q.am, Q-U-E.am. Please check out Tariq Greenfield's work at his website, tdmss.com. And a big thank you to Tariq for allowing us to use the intro and outro music that he composed. See you on episode 15.
Apple Macintosh.
Yeah, you should hear me take a wrong number. It goes on for about half an hour.
And I've just seen we never asked Jordan to describe his Mac setup. Perhaps we can do that on the next one if he's going to come back.
Yeah, sure. I run a Windows 8 machine.
Sorry?
I run a Windows 8 machine.
I see. I've got the joke now.